Welcome, and thank you for standing by. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. During the question-and-answer session, please press star one on your touch-tone phone. Today's conference is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. I now turn today's meeting over to Mr. Jesse Lauder. You may now begin, sir.
Good morning, everybody. This is Jesse Lauder from Department of Labor. I'm here with Assistant Secretary Maine and Kevin Strickland. They're going to give you a little update on the UBB investigation.
Good morning. Joe Maine here. I apologize for the delay. We came back from Beckley, West Virginia, and getting in here this morning, settled in following a meeting with the families of the miners who lost their lives in the April 5th tragedy at the Upper Big Branch mine. What I would like to do is have Kevin do an overview of where the investigation is at, and if we could walk through that first and then take questions after we complete that. Just a couple things on the front end. We are continuing our investigation, both the interview process and the underground investigation, and we're moving forward as quickly as we can to complete both of those and move on to the next level of the investigation. As customary, we always meet with the families to brief them as we do the briefings on the status of the Upper Big Branch investigation, and we had met with the families last night for probably about 3 hours to give them an overview of where things were at and where progress is, and I think we can all understand the family's just great interest here to get to the bottom of what happened at the Upper Big Branch mine, which drives us and what we are trying to accomplish. And and with that, I'll turn it over to Kevin Strickland, who is the administrator of COAL for MSHA, to do an overview. And for those who have not been part of the press conferences that we've had on this, we're probably going to give information to help bring some of you folks up to speed as well. So some have heard probably some of the information that we're going to roll through. Kevin?
Thanks, Joe. Just to bring everybody up to date on the investigation progress, we've conducted 235 interviews. We probably have about 20 more interviews that we would like to conduct. So ultimately, we're gonna go above 250 interviews as part of this investigation. The majority of the underground work has been completed. What is left is we still have to pump water in Headgate 22 and do the mapping in that area, as well as collect rock dust samples in both Headgate 22 in the face area where the water is, as well as the face area of Tailgate 22 where the water has just been recently pumped from. To date, and again, Joe mentioned some of this you may be already be aware of, we've collected over 260 pieces of evidence. We've gathered 183 documents, not including the record books and the individual data sheets that we've gotten from the mine operator, and we've taken more than 3,000 underground photos. At any time underground, we've had as many as 20 of our investigating teams doing their work. We've had rock dust teams that would, up to 10 teams that would be underground collecting rock dust samples, six mapping teams, three electrical teams, flame and forces teams, photography teams, and evidence teams. So we've focused as hard as we can to try to complete this investigation as quickly as we can. You all know it still is taking a long time. We're getting real closer. I would, as I said, guesstimate that we're somewhere around the 90 percentile or above that now to complete the investigation. Some new information that we haven't shared is we have collected 1,803 rock dust samples. When you look at the whole of all the sample that we've collected, approximately 79% of the samples are non-compliant. Now, the analysis of those samples are ongoing. We're not ready to really get into slice and dice each one of them, but we did want to share with you the overall analysis that has been completed. Again, we have a few more samples that need to be taken in the areas of Headgate 22 and Tailgate 22, but we're getting closer to having the rock dusting completed as well. Update on the electrical investigation, the electrical component of it. We've looked at the Joy Shear computer, the methane monitors on both the shear and the tail drive, and we've collected 11 total multi-gas detectors from underground and various other equipment. As far as where we've collected the methane handheld detectors from, we've gotten 5 from the Headgate 22 section, 2 from the headgate area of the longwall, 1 on the longwall face itself, and 3 on the man trip with the crew of the tailgate 22 section that were leaving the mine around crosscut 78. We're still in the process, and we've worked really hard on the longwall face of trying to find additional handheld detectors as well as the second remote control for the shearing machine. We have not been able to find it yet. It may sound a little odd to people, but the amount of work that we're putting into it, we're taking rakes, we're taking hoes, we're taking shovels up in the area to try to dig through material that may have fallen or sloughed off, and we just haven't been able to find it. We're going to continue that effort. We would normally expect there to be more than one methane detector on the longwall face. One of the questions that has come up recently is, what time did the explosion occur? And all of my information is preliminary, and it could change, but basically we've looked at the methane detector that we think shows the window of the explosion, and it would be somewhere between a time of 2:59 and 3:06. When we tie that in with the atmospheric monitoring system on the surface, we can pinpoint closer, and we think the explosion occurred at 3:02:40. That's 2 minutes after 3 and 40 seconds. That's basically the time that we're building from right now. Again, that's preliminary. What's left to do underground, I talked to you earlier, we've pumped the water out of tailgate 22. What's left is to run that water line over into headgate 22 and clear the water. There's about 4 cross cuts at the face. The water has built up and roofed in, and that water is going to have to be removed through the pumping system for us to get in there and complete the investigation. That's basically a quick rundown of what's been going on. As Joe mentioned, we shared this information with the families last evening, and I guess at this time we're willing to take any questions that you may have.
Thank you. We will now begin the question and answer session. If you would like to ask a question, please press star 1. Please unmute your phone and record your name clearly when prompted. One moment, please, for our first question, which comes from Chris Maurer. Go ahead.
Can you explain what the non-compliant rock dust samples implies? What does that mean?
Well, the regulations require that in any intake area, samples need to be 65%. In any return air core samples, the rock dust or the incombustible content needs to be at least 80%. I'm saying that in 79% of the samples that we've taken, they did not meet that minimum number.
Okay. What does that mean for the size of the explosion, you know, the accident itself?
Well,
this is Joe. This is a piece of the evidence that we'll be looking at and comparing to all the evidence that comes out of the mine, and give a little bit more information about what goes on in these kind of investigations, which just patterns after previous types of investigations on explosions. There's a collection of the mine dust in the what we call the rock dust survey, which led to the samples that we have. We examine the flame path throughout the mine to determine where flames extended to from the explosion. There's analysis of the ashing, coal ashing content within those samples. There is the physical evidence, and all of that is collectively assessed as part of the investigative process. So this will be a piece of that.
Okay. Have you been able to coordinate the, you know, the rock dust samples with the flame path itself?
That's ongoing. There's a process, and as the investigation moves forward, those pieces are you know, more hopefully coming to closure fairly quickly. But those are still all ongoing.
Okay. Thanks. One question: are you investigating whether there was a ventilation change made in the mine on the day of the accident? Is that something you're looking at?
Well, I'm not aware of any that was made, Chris, but, I mean, if our investigators, if that was done, that would be something that we would be looking at.
Okay, but nothing you can talk about or...
Well, I'm far enough away that I haven't heard that, but that doesn't mean it didn't happen. However, I'm positive that if that was occurring, that would be something the investigators would be looking at closely.
Okay, thanks. One quick thing for Joe. How do you feel about the pace of the investigation? Are you frustrated at all, or is it just expected to take this long?
I've been involved in a number of these in my lifetime, and I was telling the family members last night that, you know, in terms of major events like this, this is probably on a faster scale given the complexities that we've ran into and the size of the mine. The Wilburg mine disaster, I was trying to remember how long it took. We was, I think, over 2 years. Jim Walters, I was thinking it was about 18 months. I mean, you can move as fast as things let you move, and you can control the environment to move it. So all things considered, I think we've done as best we could with the circumstances we've had.
Okay, great. Okay, thanks a lot.
Folks, we want to get to everybody, so if you could keep it to one question for now, and we can do another round if we have time afterwards.
Thank you. Our next question then comes from Tom Costello. Go ahead.
Hi, good morning. I'm not sure I quite understand what you're saying about the 79% of samples non-compliant. I know you tried to address that just now, but for those of us who don't cover this day in and day out, can you put it into real layman's terms, please?
Let me try to do that. I'm trying to think of the best way to put it into layman's terms. It's kind of a technical thing. Basically, a mine buys rock dust from a manufacturer that comes in, it's 100% compliant. And they're to lay down and put coatings of this rock dust in their mine. And in certain areas of the mine, it's required that when it's mixed and samples are taken, that ultimately it shows that there's 65% rock dust in it in the intake air courses and 80% in the return air courses. So in other words, if we put it in a return air course, that would be, if you put it in at 100%, there could be some coal dust that could mix with it, but when you take a sample of it, it has to be 80% rock dust. What we found in the 1,800 samples that were taken at Upper Big Branch is 79% of those samples that we collected did not meet that 80 or 65% criteria or compliance requirement.
Okay, and therefore, by default, that would mean that they were more dangerous or more potentially explosive?
It would give it more potential to be involved in the explosion.
Thank you for that.
You're welcome.
Our next question comes from Kimberly Kendi. Go ahead.
Yes, I have a follow-up question on this too. My question is, with the 75% that's non-compliant, you're talking about the 65 and 80% level. How far off are we talking about? Is it, in some cases, it was 60% when it should have been 65, 75% when it should have been 80? Can you give us a sense of how far off the mark they were?
Right now, we're analyzing it, and it's all across the board. We haven't came up with a certain number. We could almost come up with 1,800 samples, naturally, you're going to have a number of different percentages.
But would you say a bulk of them were close to being on where they should be or wildly off?
I just think we want to stay with 80% of them weren't in compliance right now.
Okay. Thank you.
Our next question then comes from Siobhan Hughes. Go ahead.
Hi, on the rock dust scene again, are you surmising that somehow the rock dust might have been diluted? Is that something that you've ever seen in previous accidents?
Well, when you say diluted, I mean, we would not expect when it's put onto the mine for it to stay at 100%. That's something, I guess there's a dilution that takes place over time that we see in all of coal mines. But there is a requirement that even after the dilution, it stays at 65% in the intake or 80% in the return. That's a regulation that it's been in place for a long time. And that's something that operators have to maintain at all times.
Okay, and it stays at 65% rock dust? I mean, I guess, what's the other 35% consisting of?
It could be any other material besides rock dust. When you put it all together and you analyze it at a lab, it basically has to show that 65% of that material is non-combustible, we call it, which means it can't be on, it'll put out a fire or it'll not allow an explosion to propagate.
Okay. And then one question. Have you interviewed anyone from Massey Management?
We have interviewed some of Massey Management.
And has anyone fought the subpoenas that you had issued from Massey Management?
It's my understanding that there are some management personnel from Massey that have sent letters to the state, questioning whether the state has the authority to or whether they have to come in under the state subpoena. We really, as federal employees, we really don't have much knowledge of that because it was done with the state of West Virginia, but the state made us aware of it last evening.
Thank you.
Our next question comes from Chris Toneri. Go ahead, sir.
A follow-up with the question regarding whether or not you've interviewed Massey Managers. Have you had a chance to interview Don Blankenship?
We have not.
Have you requested that interview?
That has not been requested yet.
Will you request to interview Don Blankenship?
We're considering it right now. We haven't made that decision one way or another yet.
What would go into that consideration?
I think it's how much information he would have as far as the explosion at the UBB mine, and we would probably base that on our own interviews of other employees and information that we think he may have that would benefit us in the explosion investigation.
Okay, so there is a chance that you won't even ask to interview him.
We haven't as I said, we haven't made that decision one way or another yet.
Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Our next question comes from Dennis Roddy. Go ahead.
Kevin, I'm wondering if in the course of interviews or testimony, you have received any indications that a series of mine doors down there were being manipulated split air between the development section and the long wall, and whether any of that was ever coordinated with the visits of inspectors?
Well, I don't know. I don't want to use the word manipulated, and I've not heard that word, Dennis, but we have heard comments that there were times when these doors were left open and it would change the airflow patterns in the mine. Now, during our inspection work, I believe it was the beginning of March, we went in, and I would refer to it as a saturation inspection where we took a number of our inspectors to go to different locations in the mine to actually monitor all the face areas at the same time at the different section locations. And that's something we typically do if we think that there may be some airflows that are being changed. And I guess my point is we are looking into that. There's a lot of doors in the mine, and it's something that the investigation team is extremely in their questioning of people and in their analysis of what may have occurred will play a role in that.
But, I mean, were they – I guess I'm wondering, is there testimony that they were using these doors to try to fool inspectors as to what the airflow was in a given section when they were inspecting?
Dennis, unfortunately, we can't get into the details of the transcripts yet. Hopefully, there'll be a time forthcoming where that will be released. But right now, that's just something we're not in the position to discuss.
Thank you. Our next question comes from J. Jim Workman. Go ahead.
Yes, of the 20 people that are left to interview, are these people that have been subpoenaed, or do you anticipate having to subpoena them? And could you also give us a little rundown of how the families react over the times that you've updated them over the past couple of months?
It's my understanding, and again, this is a joint investigation between us and the state. The state has began some interviews ago to subpoena each and every person that is coming in for their interview. So the additional 20 people will be subpoenaed.
Okay.
In addition to that, just, you know, MSHA is planning a public hearing, and we will also, during the public hearing, have subpoena power to talk to the same employees if we feel that it would benefit us in the investigation process.
With regard to the families, I think since 5 o'clock, the day of April 5th, Kevin has been with every family meeting that we've had, and I think starting about sometime on the 6th, I've been part of those as well. And, you know, this is a difficult time for the families. This is, you know, they want answers to what went wrong here and, you know, what took the lives of the 29 minors. And it's an emotional time for them. You know, at times I think you have to say that, you know, you'd like to give them answers faster than you can, and they would like to have answers faster than you can produce them. And that's just the nature of what things are. I've dealt with families during these tragedies all my life, and you know, we owe them a great debt. And one of the reasons we are meeting with them constantly, and I don't think this has ever been done this extensively before in MSHA, you know, have a constant relationship with the families to try to keep them updated as much as we can. And what we tell the families is just, you know, we're trying to conduct an investigation here that we have to carry out our obligations as a federal agency, and at the same time share with them what we're able to share. And that's frustrating for both of us at times, like it is, I know, with the press, because of the limitations of trying to, you know, run an investigation. The short message is, you know, the families, you know, we have long meetings, long discussions, but the families, I think, appreciate and understand, you know, what we're trying to get to here in the investigation and come to closure with this.
Our next question comes from Howard Burkes. Go ahead.
Yes. Kevin, given the fact that Michael Ellswick's Fireboss book noted coal dust, rock dust issues just before the blast, a half hour before the blast, and now you have these samples showing that 79% of the samples are out of compliance, why wouldn't you now conclude that coal dust played a role in the spread of the explosion?
Well, I don't think we want to say one way or another. I mean, from the beginning, we said we wanted to look at every piece of the puzzle before we came up with our conclusion. I mean, I think it's fair to say that 80% in noncompliance kind of leads you to that point. But it doesn't tell us exactly how much that played a role. How big was the body of methane is one question that we have to go with. How far beyond that body of methane did the coal dust actually cause the explosion to propagate further? I can tell you this, that I've been in very few explosion investigations where coal dust did not participate in. In other words, it could have been a little bit, it could have been a lot. But typically you see it involved. So, I mean, I think it's going to be fair to say that coal dust played a role. We just don't know how big of the role is. We're going to have to get our flames and forces expert. He's going to have to evaluate the coking process, and that's why we said analysis is ongoing, and we just aren't in a position right now to say how big of a role that coal dust played.
And just quickly on the issue of Massey Energy resisting these subpoenas for their managers, I realize that that's an issue, that the state issues those subpoenas, but what does that do to your investigation if these people do not testify?
This is Joe. I think that We've made it clear that we intend to conduct a full and thorough investigation here, and as Kevin pointed out earlier, we have tools at our disposal if necessary to proceed with. But one would hope that the folks who have knowledge about what went wrong at the Upper Big Branch mine will appear in the interview process as it is currently structured, and provide information with regard to what they know and what may be helpful to identify what went wrong to prevent another reoccurrence. But there's other processes down the road.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Mark Grunberg. Go ahead.
Yeah, one question each for Joe Maine and for Kevin. For Kevin, you mentioned that you have this March sort of baseline, I guess, full-fledged investigation of the entire mine, which, I guess in medical terms you could call a baseline. Could you compare what your instruments are finding, what your analysis of the instruments are finding now with what the data was in March? And for Joe, given what we've heard and given your past experience with other explosions, it sounds like the entire mine was a hazard, not just the area that exploded. How does this compare with your other past explosions? Have you found similar things there?
I'll address the first part. When we compare what it was like in March to now, it's almost two totally different mines. And the reason for that is all of the ventilation controls that should be in place have been blown out because of the explosion. So all the air is looking to make its shortest path from where the air enters the mine at both UBB and Ellis portals to get the Bandytown fan. So the system that's in place now is nothing like the system that was in place in March. What my folks will try to do as part of the investigation, they'll try to recreate what the ventilation system was, say, at 3:01 p.m. on April the 5th, right before the explosion occurred. And they do that by going underground, determining where stoppings had been located, where doors had been located, interviewing people which direction the air was going at certain locations, were doors open, were doors closed. And from that, they try to simulate the exact route of all the air in the coal mine just prior to the explosion.
Okay. Joe?
A lot of past incidents that I've seen, and every one of them is judged on its own merits, and I don't want to be that specific, but I think that's the case. And one of the lessons I've learned a long time ago is that to collect all the facts, and when you get all the facts collected, give an assessment of what those facts mean. And we're in a situation now where we're still collecting a lot of data coming out of that mine that's going to give us, I think, at the end, a good picture of what the mine looked like, to the extent we have to, as Kevin said, try to reconstruct the ventilation system that was in place, look at what the damage is, and one of the things we haven't talked about that ties in with the coking, the flame path, samples that we collected, is also your forces and directions of forces that helps give this whole picture. So whenever all those pieces are together, we'll be able to give you a pretty straightforward assessment of what this mine was like and how it compared to some other explosions in the past.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Patrick McMurphy. Go ahead.
Thanks, guys. I've got two questions, and either Joe or Kevin, either one could answer these. It's fine. How would you characterize Massey's level of cooperation in this investigation so far?
I could say that we're working together. We're working through issues. I don't think everybody's in agreement sometimes, but we have a four-party system in place, and anytime you have four parties, not everybody's going to agree to the same thing or want to do the same thing. I think it's a tribute to all four parties that as we go through this, we're kind of coming to the conclusion. And time-wise, I don't know. We've had a number of issues, and some of them, couldn't be prevented. For instance, when we were going to start underground, we still had carbon monoxide coming out of the fan, and we were concerned to send people in. There's been holdups that I believe that everybody's tried to work through, and as far as cooperation, I mean, if there wasn't cooperation, we wouldn't be at this point now. So I think everybody wants to get this completed, find out what occurred, and try to just explain to everyone what caused the explosion and try to move forward as much as anybody can.
The Massey folks have been pointing towards a crack in the floor being the culprit in releasing a bunch of methane gas. Are you guys seeing anything that would indicate that is a possible or probable scenario?
We think it's a possible scenario. We've said that from the beginning, that we want to look at all the possible scenarios, and we've always said that that's a possibility, that we need to make a determination if that did occur. And we know we have an inundation of gas. When I say an inundation, it's a different terminology than what Massey may use. My definition of inundation is we had 5% somewhere that caused the explosion to occur. Now, maybe accumulation would be a better definition instead of an inundation, but we know we had gas or we would not have had an explosion. We have to determine how that gas got there, why it was there, and why it wasn't cleared away in the air current.
And just to add what Kevin says, during investigations, you find a number of issues that could be possibilities and probabilities, and you weed them out through the process of identifying facts and evidence that does not, that either keeps that in as a potential or weeds it out because of lack of a potential, and everything is on the table.
Well, I guess to kind of rephrase that, given the changing characteristics of the mine since the explosion back in April, will you ever be able to figure out if that crack was the source for that gas?
I'm confident that we will. If that was the source of the gas and that's what created an inundation, I'm confident that we can come up with that conclusion.
Thank you.
Our next question comes from Tim Huber. Go ahead.
Massey yesterday came out and said that stricter enforcement from MSHA is hurting its profits. It's cutting down on productivity in the Appalachian region. The converse of that would be, are mines getting safer or not? Are you guys, do you feel that you're cutting down on productivity in mines? Is that just Massey specific? Is it an industry-wide thing? And do you think the mines are getting safer?
Well, you know, I'm a believer of this, that there is a need for mine operators to implement programs at their mines that constantly examine their mines, identify hazards, and fix those. And that's not what I believe. That's what the Mine Act says that mine operators are to do. And I think what we have here is a situation where there has been a breakdown in that process, where the examinations that's finding these things are being left to MSHA to find them and force them to get fixed. And I think when the industry and it comes to grips with this issue and figures out a way to beef up their health and safety programs, to be in there examining mines, taking affirmative action, and cleaning these mines up, there's going to be less enforcement action for MSHA to take. And I think that's just the center of the universe. And I've said this to mine operators. I've been around this business for a long time. And I remember when we used to have meetings at mines, and I said this, where we'd have to have a conference room to get all the safety department in to sit down and talk about the safety issues. And sometimes that's now small enough to do in the phone booth. And I think that's representative of where we need to get back to help fix this problem. It's been something I've been talking about since the day I took this job, and something I'm going to continually talk about, because to fix it, it means the mine operators taking responsibility for the mines that they operate, to have a thorough program in place to thoroughly examine those mines and find and fix so miners aren't put at risk. Yes, I believe that the enforcement actions that we are taking are benefiting miners, because we're finding and fixing some pretty serious problems out there that, fix them before somebody gets hurt by them.
The follow-up on the coal dust issue, by the way, the 1,803 samples or whatever it is, were those all taken from areas affected by the explosion?
Tim, it started in areas just out by.
Mm-hmm.
Where the explosion started. We would have started it somewhere out by where the Mantrip was located where the miners were leaving the mine, and worked our way in until we get to the faces of all the in-by areas.
So all of those areas were everywhere in-by where that man trip was, all the way out through the Bandytown fan, et cetera, all of that was in some way affected by the explosion?
Yes.
Okay, and so there's 1,800 samples, maybe some number smaller than 1,800 is going to be from in-by that man trip.
The majority of the samples are in-by that man trip.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
In other words, that was our starting point or our ground zero. And then from there, we build a base that we take samples every 500 feet, and as we get closer to the explosion area, we'll decrease the distance to about 100 feet between samples, and then when we get on the sections, we will take it every cross-cut.
You haven't identified exactly where, though, it started, correct?
No, I don't have the exact number. That's something that we can get from a map that's been put together to show where every rock dust sample has been taken from.
No, where the explosion started. You don't know. You don't have it.
No, we don't have
it
yet.
All right. So, but you're working in by those. That mine, it had a number of rock dust violations in the past, including one on the middle of March. Has MSHA done a decent enough job? If you have more than 1,000 bad samples, is that something that MSHA should have caught earlier? Before this explosion, or is that something that this mine just simply gets a lot of coal dust around every single day and doesn't do a good job rock dusting?
Well, as far I know, we've issued 8 citations in the past 2 years
mm-hmm.
on rock dust. In addition, as far as us, you all know that we have an internal review going on of our own process,
mm-hmm.
and that's one of the things that if we lack something or we didn't do something, our internal review will bring that to light.
Are you doing rock dust samples every inspection, or is that something that you're doing only on a quarterly, monthly, something? Is it something that needs to be done every time you're in a mine, just pick up a sample?
A complete rock dust inspection or survey needs to be done on every regular inspection.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something that that every inspector does. We normally don't do it on a spot inspection or a specialty inspection, unless we know there's a problem, but typically on our EO1s or our regular inspections, that's when we would collect our rock dust samples.
Is that something that perhaps needs to be changed for mines that have a history of, say, 8 non-compliant samples in 2 years? Or
I think it's safe to say that we're in the process of evaluating all of our procedures and processes and standards for rock dusting, and more to come.
Okay. Thank you, guys.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Kelly Clark. Go ahead.
Yes. It's been reported that the methane levels have been 3 times greater than normal. Do you guys have any idea why? I know that we've mentioned the crack in the floor, but any other possibilities? Also, do you think you'll ever find a clear, definitive cause of the explosion? And if so, when?
Well, I don't think we're on this. I don't think we're in agreement that the methane level has increased 3 times. After the explosion, it may have, but that's after the oxygen has been displaced by the methane. I don't think, again, it's a possibility that there has been methane in a large quantity or an inundation that we're looking into. We're just not, that's one of the possibilities. We're not sure of that yet. As far as finding the cause of the explosion and pinpointing it, I'm confident that we can do that.
When?
As I said earlier, and this is Joe again, we're going through a process of putting all these pieces together. You know, as Kevin pointed out earlier, we got over 250 pieces of evidence that's been removed from the mine, and a number of those has to do with electrical issues. We have electrical systems we're actually piece by piece going through in the mine. And what we try to do with this process, not only electrical but other potential ignition sources, is try to spot the location of the ignition through a very methodical process. That's still ongoing. And as we look at all the ventilation scenarios and the paths that all the fuel and explosion remnants left behind to try to identify basically where the location of the fuel and ignitions occurred, and you know what impact that had, what impact the float coal dust may or may not have had. So we're a ways off from answering those questions, but we're looking at all the pieces that we should that should hopefully get us there.
Are you leaning one way or the other? I mean, can
this investigation is underway to the point that all the issues are still on the table, and it's a methodical process till you get to the end.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Robert Benincasa. Go ahead.
Yes, thank you. Kevin, the rock dust samples that you've taken them after a massive explosion. So what I'm wondering is, how reliably does the compliance level of these rock dust samples indicate the compliance level prior to the explosion?
Well, I mean, that's open for debate, I guess. When you talk to our experts, in his opinion, he'll tell you that he thinks the rock dust samples after an explosion are more probable to be better than before the explosion, because the explosion has had the opportunity to eat up or use up or burn up some of the combustible materials. So for that reason, the incombustible content should be higher after an explosion than before an explosion. And again, I don't want to get, I'm definitely not an expert at it, but I've talked to him a number of times, and that's basically the position, if he were here talking to you, he would say.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Kimberly Kendi. Go ahead.
Yes, I had another follow-up question about this 79% non-compliant. If you went into a standard, regular mine, not a perfect mine, but what would you find? Would it be, when you take samples, would you find typically 20% non-compliance, 30% non-compliance? What's the standard? What would you normally find?
Well, we find it all across the board, Kimberly, but I mean, ultimately what you want to do as an inspector, as a mine operator, is be 100% compliant with the 80% and the 65% requirement.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, there's a number of cases where we do issue violations for operators not maintaining the 65 or 80% requirement. I don't have that number in front of me. I don't have a good average number for you at this time.
Okay, and I just want to make sure I'm clear on this. The 8 citations on noncompliance with rock dust that you've issued over the past 2 years at the UB mine, those are 8 prior to the explosion, correct?
I believe, yes. I think that includes the one that we took the samples prior to the explosion, but we issued the violation after. That would be the 8th one.
Okay, thank you very much.
Welcome.
All right, folks, we are out of time. In fact, we're a little over time. Thank you, everybody, for being on the call. If there are any follow-ups from anybody or anyone needs to reach me, you can reach me at 202-693-4659 or my email, lawder.jesse@dol.gov. Thanks, everybody.